Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann this morning. Last week, presidential candidates Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton laid out their economic visions. Unsurprisingly, they differ. Clinton's proposal leans more on regulation and increased taxes on the wealthy. Trump is for tax relief and getting government off the backs of businesses. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. And joining us this week, Karen Kassler, bureau chief at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome, Karen.
Great to be here with you.
Chrissy Thompson, Columbus bureau chief for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Welcome, Chrissy.
Thank you.
And Jim Siegel, State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Good morning.
Welcome back to all of you. And let's start with that economic debate. And Jim, I'll start with you. What do you make of them? I'm not a big economic, obviously, don't have, that's not my wheelhouse economy. But compared to the two, who's looked the best?
Well, I'll let other people decide what's best and what's not. But there's certainly a difference, particularly, you know, with taxes. I believe Trump wants to reduce the current income tax brackets down to 3. I think he would lower the top rate from like 39.5% to about 35%. He wants to do, I think, child care tax credits. Hillary Clinton also has some child care language in hers as well. I don't think she would do much with the tax rates on the middle class. It would be more about increasing the tax rates on the wealthy. So that she could help, you know, to help balance out some other things she wants to do. I believe that some of the criticism I've heard is that the both plans don't address much on the debt, the national debt problem. In fact, Donald Trump's would explode it, from what I've seen from some reports, that he's cutting trillions of dollars in revenue over the next decade, and also calling for increased spending on some some infrastructure and other things. So his plan is, I've seen his plan get criticized by even some conservatives who were, you know, not happy that he didn't address the debt, not happy that he didn't address Social Security and Medicare, which are going continue to spiral into oblivion in terms of how far behind they are in revenue, and then he didn't address things like, you know, the working class is his group. Those are his big supporters. What are you offering them in terms of job training or wage subsidies and such that even Paul Ryan has supported in some respects? So.
I think it's significant that they both did their speeches in Michigan and talked about manufacturing and trade deals, because these are big issues in the economic debates, not only in the presidential contest, but also when you look down into the U.S. Senate race here in Ohio. It's a big deal in the Ted Strickland, Rob Portman race. So I think it's very significant that they both picked that venue. And, today we're supposed to be hearing a little bit about foreign policy. But Jim's absolutely right. I think what Trump and Clinton both have to do in terms of speaking to the Ohio voters that they're trying to reach, those disaffected voters who feel that they've been cut out of the economy, blue-collar workers who feel like that they're not getting what they want out of the economy. I think, you know, both of these plans do have to speak a little bit more to that. And so, NPR did a little piece on it, I think, last week about the differences between the two plans, but did mention that they did have in common the idea that they both are trying to deal with this issue of manufacturing and fair trade deals.
You know, one thing that we have heard, at least I have heard when I've talked to voters here in Ohio, oftentimes I'll meet working class or lower income voters who will essentially echo most of Trump's platform pieces, such as on immigration, on issues like that. And you'll hear them say, but I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton. And you say, don't you agree with Trump on immigration? Don't you agree with him on some of these other issues? And they'll say, yeah, I think he's totally right on that. The thing is that Hillary Clinton, she says what I want to hear. She talks about programs that I think benefit me. And that's something that a lot of working class and lower income Ohioans do care about. They care about, continuing to get several people brought up how they now have health care through Medicaid expansion, and that Hillary Clinton supports Obamacare and wants to keep that in place. And it's been great for them. They would really like to continue to have that, those sorts of things. And that's something that Trump needs to be able to connect with these people on. And he certainly is connecting with a large swath of working class Ohioans and Americans. But there are some who are looking for these specific proposals. And that's something that Hillary Clinton has the upper hand on.
And I think you used that word specific. And that might be the problem with Trump, is he's not specific enough, especially to the people that he wants to reach.
To some people, I think there are plenty of folks here in Ohio and around the country who feel like they connect with Trump on things that make them that they talk about a feeling. You know, Trump is speaking out of his heart, and I agree with him, you know, and how they feel when he speaks, even if they don't know all the specifics. But, you know, one thing we hear a lot in Ohio, we are a state that really does like specifics. We like actual proposals. I mean, you look at the Republicans and Democrats who have come out of Ohio, you know, people like John Kasich, who his big thing when he was running for president was balancing the budget. You know, that's not an issue for Trump. So many Republicans who support Trump have told me that they really wish that he would just kind of put a few more bits of meat on the bones of the feelings of the, you know, make America great again. That is his main platform piece right now.
There was a piece in the New York Times, though, this weekend talking a little bit about the behind-the-scenes things that are going on in the Trump campaign. And it sounded like the economic policy that was put together really was kind of by committee. And he basically ended up with two guys in the end, Stephen Moore from the Heritage Foundation and Arthur Laffer, trying to decide which of these two gentlemen he wanted to side with, in a sense. And so I think, you know, the idea of more specifics and putting more meat on the bones of that, it's, you know, I think he's still forming what he wants to do, maybe, and trying to put together all of the plan. And you know, it sounds like, at least if you read this New York Times article, and there have been other ones, that there's a little bit of, you know, chaos and disorganization maybe in the Trump campaign from behind the scenes.
Definitely.
Though, of course, Trump has now said that this is not true. This is not what's happening. And Paul Manafort was on the talk shows yesterday saying it's not happening. So that's out there, though.
Well, go ahead, Jim.
I was just going to say, I think one of the things, and this I think is the stuff that will come up during the debates, assuming that Donald Trump attends.
Well, yeah, that's, I mean, I'll finish your thought, but I want to go back to that because I feel like at this point he's almost setting everybody up for why he's not going to be in the debate. So go ahead.
Right. Well, I mean, and this often happens. This is not just Donald Trump who puts out economic proposals that, when you start to dig into them, maybe are a little unrealistic. I mean, at some point he's going to have to answer, or he's going to at least be asked to answer, how do you do a tax plan where you get rid of $9 trillion out of revenues and still manage to not send, you know, the budget into an even further, even a broader deficit and even more debt. I mean, more and more groups are talking about the debt. I mean, there's ads running now from a national group talking about, you know, we need some plans on how to deal with the debt. Let's not forget about it. I mean, you remember John Kasich. That was how he kind of got started with his presidential campaign, was going around trying to do a balanced budget amendment. And I mean, that faded away as a topic, but there's a lot of people still worried about it. And, you know, when you're talking about doing things like getting rid of the, you know, Trump wants to get rid of the estate tax. Well, I mean, Ohio got rid of its estate tax, but Ohio's estate tax was a lot lower threshold. I mean, at the national level, I believe it's $5.4 million is the inheritance which you start paying an estate tax, which I think is less than 0.5% of the estates out there. So, I mean, he's throwing out proposals like that I think, I don't know how the folks at Youngstown today who are going to go to his rally, how do they feel like they benefit from an estate tax elimination when it's, you know, clearly none of them would benefit from it.
Right. Well, we have heard over the weekend that he started to put out tweets and other things, not necessarily being in a debate. Has that ever happened, that a presidential candidate just refused to debate the other candidate in a presidential campaign? I don't remember.
I can't remember
it
either.
I can't think of one.
I think it's extraordinary. I mean, now he has a track record of following through on that, because there was at least one debate that he didn't show up for. It was just the one, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Just the Fox News debate in Iowa. And he didn't win Iowa. Let's point that out, although I don't think it was probably because of that debate. But
right. And there were also, I think, 15 debates he probably did show up for. I don't know the exact number.
It was around
there
then.
Were a lot of debates in the Republic. There's only
the people saw him.
You know, yeah, there's only three. There's only three in the general election. So he can't use it as an excuse, is that, you know, we're just debating too much. And I know it's just going to be fascinating when the two of them get together and are forced to go back and forth. I think, you know, there was a recent poll out said if there was an NFL game on with your team versus the debate, you know, I think 68% said they'd watch the debate. So it's going to get a lot of views.
You know, I think it'll be interesting if we do see them head to head. And perhaps this is on Trump's mind, although I really doubt it. But, you know, one thing when we're talking about these economic plans that Hillary Clinton says quite a bit is, I'm actually going to pay for these things that I'm promising you. And here's how. And she talks about increasing taxes on the very wealthy and on corporations. Now, as Jim mentioned, no politician, and certainly Hillary Clinton's economic plan is not as cut and dry as she would like to make it seem. You know, different groups will continue to look at the numbers and will highlight ways that, you know, things might fall short, and she's certainly not going to balance the budget, things like that. However, you know, Trump has been criticized by Republicans since the primaries. For at least a year, he's been criticized for having an economic plan that does not add up. And it's just really interesting to think of the two of them on a stage together with Hillary Clinton saying, I will pay for these things and this is why. And with Trump not really having a plan that adds up, he's counting on economic growth to balance the budget, which we've seen in many areas. Kansas is an example, cutting taxes with the hope that economic growth will just make up that. That shortfall has not played out in reality.
No, I don't think that's ever. I can't think of a situation where that has actually, you know, come to fruition. Even in Ohio, where, you know, we cut taxes here, but we are, you know, the revenues didn't grow as much as, you know, our income tax revenue these days is much lower than it used to be because of those income tax cuts. Now, you can certainly argue the policy that's been a good thing for the overall state of Ohio, but it didn't mean that we brought in more revenue because of that. At least it doesn't appear that way. I mean, more revenue is coming in general, I think it's hard to argue that it's just because that the income tax paid for itself eventually. I mean, it's a tough thing to, because you're also trying to argue what if we didn't do this, what would have happened? And you can't really argue the unknown.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable discussion. And this morning, an update on the presidential campaign. If you have questions, comments, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org. Youngstown today is where Trump will be to talk about foreign policy. And Karen, this is not something that we've heard a lot of either. You think we'll hear more details?
Who knows? I mean, you know, that's I think it's one of the reasons why Trump rallies are shown live on television is because, you know, we're told that there are going to be certain things, but then other things are often said. In some of the behind the scenes articles that have been published recently, there's been a lot of talk about the Trump team trying to keep him on message, trying to keep him on the teleprompter and reading the script as it's been written for him. And that he's been less than willing to do that. But, you know, there's also the idea of that his supporters really like the fact that he doesn't stick to exactly what's written, that he embellishes, that he talks about other things that are beyond what has been prescribed for him to talk about. So I think, you know, we're told that's what he's going to talk about. I'm sure that's where he'll start. But, you know, where it goes from there, who knows? And so, I mean, I'll be interested to hear what he has to say. That's for sure.
Typically in these speeches, there's about 350 people that are going to be allowed into this. This isn't one of his typical rallies. Typically in these speeches, he has read from a teleprompter, although that doesn't mean that the interesting ad-libs definitely still happen in these speeches, especially often the campaign will send out a transcript right as he starts speaking with his prepared remarks, and it's very interesting to compare them. So certainly, you know, we'll see what happens, but I think to Karen's point, this campaign just continues to highlight, as we were just speaking about earlier with the economic plans, that Trump is really at least winning with the segment of America that just feels upset. They want. I'm going to use the word hero. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but they're looking for somebody who can say
a white knight, come in.
This is a problem, and we're gonna you know. harp on the feeling of we need to make our country great again, and really harp on the feeling of I've spoken to a lot of Ohioans for a series that we did right before the conventions who they feel like immigrants are taking their jobs. They feel like they are losing out because of the way that the country is diversifying and changing. And Trump is speaking to those people. And then you have Hillary Clinton speaking to really the segment of the American population that's just looking for someone to be a normal president. Like, give me some policies. Do you have a policy, you know, with a few more bullet points and numbers in them? And like I said, most politicians' proposals don't add up perfectly. But that's really the difference between these two.
Well, he's giving a foreign policy speech today, and it would, I think, for him, it would be good to offer some clarity on where it is exactly he stands on some of these foreign policy issues. You know, he's been stepping in it recently by saying things like, well, you know, Barack Obama is the founder of ISIS. That's not a foreign policy stance. That's absurdity. And then when asked, no, that's not really what you meant, is it? He said, no, that's exactly what I meant. He's the founder of ISIS. And then he gets mad at the media for reporting that. So you can't, he needs to avoid going up on stage and saying stuff like that. You can certainly criticize Barack Obama's the way he's dealt with ISIS and Hillary Clinton. You can certainly offer up a lot of intelligent criticisms of what they've done or haven't done. But you can't do that. And then also, you know, you can't say we need to destroy ISIS and then also say, well, we need to pull back out of the Middle East and not get involved. He's got to start offering up some clarity as to what is he talking about when he says we got to destroy ISIS? Are we sending in troops? There's been a lot of people fearing that, you know, he brings up the nuclear option in private meetings. Those have been reported. I mean, that's kind of worrisome people. And also, I think I want to hear what is he going to say about Vladimir Putin? There continues to be more and more stories out there about him and his top
Manafort.
Folks, Paul Manafort, yeah. The chief among them, and their close ties to Putin and the former Ukrainian president who was pro-Russia. And, it just continues a snowball for him and it's not going away. And he really should address it in some form.
Coming up, we continue our weekly roundtable reporter discussion. And this time it's about U.S. Senate race between Republican U.S. Senator Rob Portman and Democratic challenger Ted Strickland. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann Fisher. Republican U.S. Senator Rob Portman has raced to a 9-point lead over Democratic challenger Ted Strickland. That's according to a Quinnipiac University poll released last week. The numbers also signal the largest lead Portman has received in a poll since the Senate race began. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us in the studio, Karen Kassler, bureau chief at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Chrissy Thompson, Columbus bureau chief for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Jim Siegel, State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. And before we get on to the Senate race, I just wanted to share with you something that the USA Today put out this morning, and it's a poll that shows Trump is losing ground among young people. And Chrissy, you were talking about those who seem to, you know, follow him. Young people apparently are not one of the groups that are enfranchised with him.
Yeah, I think this comes from several things, but my gut is, I haven't done a young people story here, but my gut is from talking to some folks across the state is that they are really feeling as though Donald Trump is not in favor of diversity. And this is a group that has grown up in a country that is diverse and they like it that way. This is a group that is, you hear a lot about young people trying to be more globalized. And, you know, they talk a lot about how, honestly, this is kind of where Bernie Sanders came from. They talk a lot about how in Europe, these countries that are socialist, they pay for these things and we should do that here in the U.S., you know, and that's, they feel like solutions to things like poverty and their student debt. And, Donald Trump just seems, the antithesis of all of these sorts of principles to them, from the Muslim immigration ban to the wall with Mexico, to, you know, just a lot of, I think even the anti-trade stuff, which, okay, that was a Sanders thing, but I really feel like that, that kind of also idea of kind of closing off our country from the rest of the world.
And isolationism?
Yeah, that's not what you hear millennials talking about.
And I was just looking through the Quinnipiac poll, the last one that came out. And this is a significant poll, the one that came out last week, because it was the first likely voters poll in Ohio instead of just registered voters, but likely voters. And trying to see if there was an age breakdown, and there wasn't, though if there was, someone will correct me and let me know. But, you know, the groups that the candidates are still winning with seem to still be the same groups. And you know, Hillary Clinton is favored among non-whites. Trump is favored among whites. You know, Trump is favored among men. Clinton wins with women. You know, and there are definitely these breakdowns here. And the whole idea, though, of the younger voters. I mean, we've heard a lot about how younger voters don't vote in the numbers that older voters vote in. But certainly the Obama campaign had targeted younger voters. And there's a lot of people out there who are in that age group who joined the whole system because of Bernie Sanders. They thought what he was talking about was interesting. Some actually did find Donald Trump a refreshing change from the, quote, establishment candidates, and then later on decided that maybe his message wasn't exactly the one they wanted to hear. But I think, you know, at least with two very well-known, though albeit unpopular candidates here, you do have at least people engaged, people talking about these two candidates whose names they've heard their whole lives. I mean, you know, millennials grew up knowing Donald Trump from television and Hillary Clinton had been the first lady. You know, so I think that at least there's maybe a little bit more conversation among millennials about these two people who are running.
All right, on to the U.S. Senate race. This is the largest lead in the Senate campaign so far for Portman. What is contributing to him pulling away?
Well, he's getting more support among women than Republicans tend to do. I mean, right now, I think that poll had him tied with Strickland among women in Ohio, but he leads quite a bit, but among the men, and that's attributing. I think it's like a 10-point lead among men, which is attributing to his 9-point lead overall. And frankly, he's just been very aggressive. You know, Portman has been very active. He's been all over the state. He's been running tons of ads. He's raised a lot of money, and he's been swamping Ted Strickland with messaging. And Strickland, you know, I mean, I haven't been covering the race that closely, but I know that those who have. I mean, he, you know, it's just you haven't felt the energy out of his campaign. Let's just put it that way. I'll just try to be nice. Say you haven't really felt the energy out of his campaign thus far. I mean, Strickland, there's been a concern. He just hasn't been as aggressive as he should be in terms of getting out there and making appearances and getting on TV. And he has now reserved, I think, $8 million worth of television. That doesn't mean it'll put up $8 million, but that's what he's reserved. But I think Portman's reserved, you know, I think he's in the double digits in terms of how much he's got left to reserve for the
It's an expensive campaign.
Oh, it's very expensive. One of the most expensive. They're projecting it could be the most expensive in the country, although if these poll numbers don't change, you'll start seeing a lot of third-party money pulling out and moving to other states where the Democrats think they have a better chance of pickups.
Yeah.
And I was just going to say, looking at the Quinnipiac poll, it's worse than you were suggesting for Strickland when it comes to men. Portman leads Strickland 55% to 36%. Okay. So and tied with women. So there's definitely work to do, so to speak. Strickland is now on the air with his own ads, because before it was any Strickland ad that you saw or any anti-Portman ad. Well, I can't say any anti-Portman ad, but there was a lot of dark money. There was a supporting ads from unions and other groups. But Strickland is now on the air with his own ads. Strickland has said from the beginning he was going to have less money than Portman. And that's – he knew it. Everybody knew it. He claimed that he wasn't going to need the money because he did come into the race with name recognition that Portman didn't have because he'd been a governor. And governors tend to have better name recognition than U.S. senators. And even incumbent U.S. senators, apparently. And I think, though, that's been eroded now. I mean, when you talk about a 9-point gap between the two, that's pretty significant.
Yeah, I will say that the Strickland campaign says that even beyond the name recognition, that they do not need to have the organization and money that Rob Portman has because they can tie themselves unapologetically to Hillary Clinton, and that in the end, people will come out, they'll vote for Hillary Clinton, they will vote for Ted Strickland, they're going to vote down the ticket that way. They, you know, Rob Portman, the Trump campaign continues to struggle in Ohio. You know, finally at the end of last week said they were going to open some Ohio offices, but I left out, for instance, arguably the most important swing county in the state, Hamilton County. You know, if Republicans don't win Hamilton County, they don't win the White House. That just is what's happened the last several cycles. So there's no office from the Trump campaign down there. And there have been an email that the Cincinnati Inquirer obtained, for instance, where, you know, Trump's employees were campaign employees were talking about whether they're even being supported by the people in Hamilton County. So anyway, all that to say, they say that Portman needs to run his own campaign and can't rely on the top of the ticket, whereas the Strickland campaign can. But I mean, these poll numbers are troubling. They're basically just going to, right now, they're making a bet that this pulled out correctly for them. But Portman is getting his message out.
Yeah, I think it helps. For Republicans, this is a good sign in that there's clearly, at least in these polls, showing that there's going to be a lot of split ticket voting, where you're going to see a lot of folks either not vote for president or vote for Clinton, but then vote for Portman and then maybe vote for Republicans down the ticket. That is also what the Republican legislative leaders are hoping for as well, is that they are, because I mean, I have heard some folks talk about some polling in Franklin County, and Trump is getting just obliterated around Franklin County right now. And that is not good news if you're running as a Republican in Franklin County and in legislative races. It's making things a lot tougher, even though you have nice, well-drawn districts for yourselves. So that's what they really are hoping, that there's going to be a lot of ticket splitting or people who, you know, go Republican and still go to Republicans, still go to the ballot, even if they're not planning to vote in the presidential race.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable discussion. In this hour, the U.S. Senate race between Republican Ron Portman and Democrat Ted Strickland. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email allsides@wosu.org. It also seems as if that Portman is receiving outside help from the Republican Party for people who don't feel that they want to support Trump, but they want to support somebody in a race that they deem important. And this is one that they think is really important.
Yeah, you know, there are many groups. So the actual Republican Party's organizing is focusing heavily on Portman, but also on Trump as of right now. We've seen some reports in recent days that the RNC has suggested that they could stop supporting Trump at some point and focus all of their efforts on Senate races. But we're not quite at that point right now. But there are many Republican groups. For instance, John Kasich, his top political operatives from his presidential campaign, started their own PAC just to target these new registered Republicans and try to basically sell them on Portman. You know, those guys honestly aren't big Trump fans. They declined a chance to work for him. And they feel like they can try to tell these voters who voted in the primary in the Republican Party that they've got this great guy in Rob Portman and you should vote for him. And honestly, when you talk to voters, even if they haven't split a ticket in decades, most of them say that they're willing to. They think of themselves as independents and think of themselves as willing to split that ticket. So this could be the year when we see that happen. So
I think there's only been one time that whoever was the Republican candidate for president, that another candidate for Senate won.
It's unusual.
So it is very unusual. But that, of course, is the fear that somehow if Trump doesn't win, then Strickland, you know, that. And so I think that's the real concern, is to try to make sure among Republicans who are very clear in Ohio, there might be casual support for the nominee, not necessarily by name, but they're very strong in their support for Rob Portman and the other Republicans who are on the ballot. I think we heard that in Cleveland, where the Ohio delegation was very lukewarm on Trump, but absolutely positive on Rob Portman and the rest of the ticket. And so I think there's a real concern among Republicans that if Trump completely tanks in Ohio, what does that do to Portman and the rest of the Republicans?
Right. I mean, right now, Trump or Hillary Clinton's leading in the polls in Ohio by 2 to 4 points, depending on the poll. I mean, the Republicans worry if that gets to 6, 8, 10 points. I mean, there's only so much that Rob Portman can absorb. And that right. you know, eventually it will, you know, it will overwhelm him. But they don't think they're there yet. But there is a concern that it, if Trump continues to struggle, that it could head that direction.
And the reason they want to keep him in the Senate is
because
the majority.
They want to keep the Senate. Right. Yeah. Right. It's going to be a
he's a Republican.
Yeah, it's very, well, it's going to be very close as to who controls the Senate by the, you know, by the time it's all over in November, regardless of which party has it. It's going to be a close count. So
I have an email from Brad here. Can the panel shed some light on the claim that 89 cents was left in the rainy day fund when Ted Strickland was governor? I don't see how that claim can be taken seriously. It seems completely out of context. I'm sure Ohio's economic conditions during that time had something to do with it.
Yes.
Oh, it absolutely did.
They did. Yes, that's true.
Well, just really quick, there was over $1 billion in the rainy day fund. We hit the Great Recession. Like every other state in the country, our revenues went into historically bad, and they drained the rainy day fund in order to try to, you know, not.
Keep
the state solvent and to avoid having to make even more drastic cuts or tax increases. So, yeah, it went from over $1 billion down to 89 cents. However, by the time Strickland left office, it was back up to – by the time Strickland's final budget was done, which is actually 6 months after he leaves office, by the time his final budget done, that rainy day fund was back up to about $400 million and was on the way up.
And I think there was also a period where there were the Taft tax cuts going back to 2004 that Strickland had suspended 1 year of those tax cuts and then continued the tax cuts. So, you know, there was still a continuing cycle of trying to keep tax cuts going. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of people who say that blew a big hole in the budget and really potentially could have drained the rainy day fund even as we were facing the Great Recession. So the argument is that, you know, just saying that 89 cents was in the rainy day fund when he left, that may be factually true, but there were a lot of other things that were going on. And there's evidence to suggest that as he was leaving, like Jim was saying, as he left office, the economy was rebounding. Things were getting better. And there are plenty of people who say that Governor Kasich has benefited from some of the things that happened in the last year or so of Strickland's time in office.
It's one of those things where the ad is true but not necessarily accurate.
You got to know the backstory, right?
You know, there's another doozy out right now. And one of the reasons I think that Portman is doing so well with women is this massive ad campaign they've been doing on his actions to fight the heroin epidemic. And really, I think that ad really connects really well with women voters who are looking for someone to fight for them and their families. We see that a lot in polls. There's an ad that just went up a couple of days ago. I saw it over the weekend while I was watching the Olympics coverage, so probably everybody else did too, saying, hey, Portman actually voted against heroin funding when he was in Congress. And the truth is that he voted against a budget bill that had some money to fight the heroin epidemic in that bill, but also had tons of other things in it. And we hear that, you know, over and over and over again from the state legislative level on up. You know, why did you vote against the budget when it had this one little piece that you obviously support? You know, and that's something that folks have to make their minds up looking as a whole. And is it, you know, Portman did get his heroin bill passed, and he feels like it has made a difference. It's really not fair to say he voted against heroin money and he doesn't like heroin when a lot of other people voted against that bill, too.
I once had a veteran Republican lawmaker tell me, if you can't find anything negative to say about me, you haven't looked at my budget votes.
Right.
Coming up, we continue our weekly reporter roundtable and discuss the ongoing legal battle over online charter school ECOT. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann Fisher. The legal battle over the state's largest online charter school, ECOT, Electronic School of Tomorrow, rages on. After the e-school turned over thousands of its records last week, it now wants some of them back, citing an invasion of student privacy. In addition, ECOT is hitting back against the state education department with new TV ads to rally support. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us in the studio, Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Chrissy Thompson, Columbus Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Jim Siegel, Statehouse Reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks for being with us again this morning, all. Jim, catch us up to speed with where things are with ECOT since last week. Things are happening quickly there.
Well, there's a lot of stuff going on. I don't know that the courts are going to move all, you know, how quickly that's going to move through. But yeah, basically last week ago, it was 2 weeks ago now, ECOT was ordered by a judge to turn over the attendance records. And so they did about 4 days later. They turned over thousands and thousands of documents and pile, you know, stacks of banker's boxes. I don't think made the Department of Education very happy. Department of Education, of course, would much rather just see a bunch of electronic files that they can just go through. But I think I don't think ECOT is right now trying to do anything to make it easier on the Department of Education. And then so they turned these records over, and then not long after made the argument that, hey, wait a minute, these records include student names, and the Department of Education is not allowed to have that. So you're violating privacy, and you're making copies of these records, and you're violating student privacy laws. And so I don't know where that's going to land. I know that the department said, fine, you don't want us to have these names. Well, you shouldn't have given them to us with the names on them. You should have given them to us with the student ID numbers, which we can't track. So now we're in this little tussle over, you know, how will the records ultimately look, and who's going to, you know, whether, you know, there are going to be privacy problems. But I do think the department eventually is going to have the records and be able to look at them all. And, you know, but ECOT's doing what it can to try to throw up roadblocks in front of this attendance audit that would eventually be used to determine what their funding is. And I think that it's just going to, you know, the legal fights are going to continue on these fronts. And it's not going to – they're not going to go quietly, as we can tell by the ads are running pretty consistently.
Right. The ads are remarkable because, I mean, there's no vote on this, you know, but just trying to change public perception.
We're going to listen to a portion of one since we're speaking of it.
I didn't have electricity all the time. I had to walk to the library to log into school. But ECOT gave me the hope to get through. Now the Ohio Department of Education wants to close ECOT. Why would they do that? Where will I go?
The timing of these ads is because of what's going on, obviously. What is significant about the timing? You said there's no voter out there who can do anything about this. Is it just to persuade public opinion?
Yeah, this is all about political pressure. They're trying to apply political pressure on the legislature, on the Department of Education, on the governor's office to leave them alone and not require these, you know, them to turn over logins and not do this in-depth look at their attendance. Now, you know, basically the state, you get paid based on how many students you have. And if the state determines that you have a lot fewer full-time students than you say you do, they're going to lose tens of millions of dollars. Now, to stand up and argue, why does the department want, you know, department want to shut down ECOT? The department does not want to shut down ECOT. The department wants to count how many students ECOT really has attending, wants to determine if those students are really attending class or not. And because it would be one thing if ECOT had really good grades and really good academic performance, but at the same time also had these issues, they could at least say, look, we're still producing really good results. But they can't. And that's also part of this problem, is that they have very poor academic results. And now they have there's a lot of questions about their attendance and whether kids are really logging in and doing the work.
39% graduation rate. That's what ECOT has, a 39% graduation rate compared to in the 70s, 80s, 90% in other districts. And there's a lot of money at stake here. It's $109 million, I think, in the last year. And the audit is only for 1 year. The audits are done every 5 years, but the audit is only done for 1 year. So, you know, there's a lot of money that will still be there that is not being looked at in terms of the 1 year audit. And so, you know, the whole idea of students have to be in class for 920 hours. How do you prove that? And the Ohio Department of Education has said, we want the login records to prove that these kids were in class an average of 5 hours a day. That's what it's supposed to be. And they claim that a preliminary audit showed that kids were only, most kids at ECOT were logging on for an hour a day. Now, ECOT says that's not right, that that was data that just showed the kind of information they could collect on students, but that they didn't collect on students. And so the question really becomes, though, how do you prove that these kids are getting this 5 hour a day education for 920 hours per year, which is what the state is paying for? And last week, State Auditor Dave Yost, who's been a supporter of charter schools, convened a charter school summit. He had charter school supporters there and called for charter school reforms, including changing the way that the funding is done and trying to assess students more regularly and not waiting for grading periods and try to track their progress a little bit more carefully to try to get an idea of where these students are and really if they are logging on and doing the work they're supposed to be doing. Now, you know, ECOT and some of the other schools have claimed that logging on is not the only way to track students because there are opportunities to learn, such as reading books and going on trips and doing these other things. But, you know, the whole issue of accountability and making sure that the state is getting what it's paying for in terms of those kids actually learning and being able to pass tests and do all the things that traditional public school students have to do, that's the real issue.
But I think there are some families that really support this. I've seen editorials now written, and the families are starting to get upset, the ones that believe ECOT is helping their students, because they feel that the state hasn't talked to them at all. Am I right?
Well, one of the issues here is that whether or not there are students – I mean, I don't think anyone doubts there are students that are helped by ECOT and online education. But there's almost a point where you say, well, it's – you know, I think from the state's perspective is – at least on in terms of attendance, it's irrelevant. It's not about whether there, you know, ECOT can find, you know, a dozen students to tell you how they've been helped by the school. It's about how many of your 15,000 kids are really doing logging in and doing the work when you have an attendant, you know, you have a graduation rate of 38%. How many of them are actually participating in the education that you're offering? And ECOT is arguing, look, back, you know, for years now, all you've required of us is a teacher certification. Basically, teachers would sign a form that said students were offered 920 hours and, you know, their teacher would sign it. And then there really weren't a lot of other checks. Now the department has gotten tougher. The department has said, no, we're going to start looking for the documentation behind these certifications. And that's where we are with the fight now.
And really, you know, Republicans will even say this. The issue here is that ECOT is the last resort option. Your kid, you know, perhaps you want to homeschool your child and use ECOT, and that's where some of this outrage is coming from. But in many cases, your child has been bullied in school, hasn't done well in school, has shuttled through, you know, been maybe perhaps been expelled from school and then gone to, you know, maybe an alternative school or another charter. Just this is the last option for getting this child an education. And so the graduation rates are not great. The state in some ways is saying we understand that. However, we are trying to educate our students. I mean, think of the thousands of students in this school who are not graduating given this 39% graduation rate. And so if this school is not actually teaching these children, we've got to come up with some other option for them is part of the argument here. The other argument is, look, perhaps, you know, this is last resort and maybe some of these children are not going to succeed in this environment, but we're not going to give you all this money to educate them if you're not really educating them. So,
right. I mean, they're getting $6,000 a student or more. And so it adds up quick once you you start, you know, deciding that a lot of your students are only actually participating, let's just say half the time that they're supposed to. I mean, there's $55 million right there.
And the point of these accountability measures is to say, well, look, this would be a lot easier if you could get a higher graduation rate and get your students participating better. Maybe you will use your money more wisely and come up with other ways to help get these children through this program successfully. So that's kind of the point of all these accountability measures.
And ECOT has said that, you know, if the money is taken away, the school will shut down. And that's kind of going back to the commercials there. Why would the state try to shut us down? That's ECOT's claim, that if indeed that money is taken away, then that will shut the school down. But the issue becomes, you know, 920 hours, that's in state law. And right. if they can't prove that those kids are getting 920 hours, well, then the argument goes, why should the state be paying for that? And so that's the question I think that has to be answered. And it's the kind of thing when Dave Yost was talking about lawmakers coming back this fall after the election and doing something on charter school reform. Is that the kind of thing they're going to do? Are they going to really get into the whole idea of 920 hours? Is that still what we want for students to have? And if so, how do these online schools especially, how do they maintain that? How do they prove that?
That was my next question, was how will this ECOD, whatever happens with this lawsuit and what the Department of Education is doing, how will that affect other schools that are charter schools, not just online charter schools, but all charter schools?
It mostly would affect the online schools, because a traditional charter school can keep account the same way a traditional public school can. You know, you take account once or twice a year on number of students that are there, and it can be verified by, you know, the number of students that are actually sitting in the classrooms. However, this didn't start with ECOT. Last year, there was a school called Provost Academy that had to pay back 80% of its funding because of the same problem. Now 80% of their funding was only about $800,000. So while it made some waves, it wasn't nearly to the effect of what it would be if this was they got about $1 million a year. ECOT gets about $510,000. And so there is a concern that if the department is ultimately prevails in this, that it's not just going to be ECOT. There's going to be all kinds of online schools are going to have to start showing this, you know, these records, and some of them could be in trouble in terms of actually producing, you know, evidence that their students are attending 920 hours a year. Now, some may be able to do so just fine. I really don't know, but I do know that there is concern that it's not just going to be ECOT. And I know Karen mentioned earlier that these audits are done every 5 years. If they find a problem with your audit, they'll start doing you every year. So this will become an ongoing issue. If they decide ECOT owes money, they're not just going to let them off the hook for another 5 years. They're going to come back and ask for the records again next year.
You wrote a piece about the history of ECOT, Jim, and over the weekend. It seems like this has been not necessarily this particular problem, but problems in general with ECOT for a very long time.
Yeah, this has been going back 15 years. Now, one of the things that ECOT is hanging its hat on in their lawsuit is that they've got this 2003 funding agreement that they signed with the state that says, that lays out somewhat as to what you can check in terms of determining attendance. And they say, look, login durations are not on that list, and so you can't do that. You're violating the settlement. It was a settlement reached after Auditor Jim Petro did an audit and found that there were issues with their financials, and they couldn't verify that they were going to be, that their financials were sound. And so they kind of came to this settlement, and there was efforts to get online regulations put into law. The legislature did not act on a couple different occasions, and there were some of the same arguments being made now about you're changing the rules on us and you're not allowed to do this. There was kind of similar to what was done back then. So this has been ongoing for a bit. It's just only come to a head now in the last year or so, as I think the department has sort of realize that this is really an issue and needs to be looked at. And frankly, the question is, where did the department suddenly decide that this is what they want to do? I mean, clearly there's been discussions of whether, is this coming from the governor's office? Is this coming from other places that the department suddenly decided that they were going to start looking at the documentation behind the claims that there were 920 hours.
Jim can give a better perspective because he covers this full time and I do not. But there are several high powered connected Republican people, donors, lobbyists, et cetera, connected with ECOT. And so in some ways it's slightly remarkable to see, these accountability measures being applied so stridently at this time. But perhaps Jim can give more perspective on that.
Well, no, there are some in the legislature who are surprised that it's happening and not happy about it. Bill Lager, the founder of ECOT, he also runs the management company and sells the software to ECOT. Millions and millions of dollars go to his companies through ECOT and each year. And he has given $1.2 million to Republicans in the last 5 years. making him one of the largest legislative Republican donors, going in the last few years. I mean, there's a reason that this has kind of festered for 15 years, and it's not because no one noticed. It's because no one just acted on it. So,
and the House Speaker Cliff Rosenberger was the speaker at the graduation for ECOT this year. Yep. It should be noted too. There,
interesting. That's all the time we have. Thank you all for being here. Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks, Karen.
Great to be here.
Chrissy Thompson, Columbus Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Choir. Thanks, Chrissy.
Thank you.
And Jim Siegel, State House Reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Thank you, Jim.
Yep.
And thank you all for joining us. All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.